You ever try to like diffuse a ticking time bomb while your house is actively on fire? And to make matters worse, your roommates are in the kitchen having a literal knife fight over who holds the deed to the property.
Yeah, that is basically the perfect visual for what we are looking at today.
Right. It's just profoundly stressful. But that visual perfectly encapsulates the absolute chaos we are staring at. We are looking at a massive, sprawling stack of notes, session journals, and just raw lore from this epic tabletop campaign known as the Holland Codex.
Which is just a brilliant campaign.
Oh, totally. But here is the kicker, right? We are right at the finish line. There are only about two or three games left in this entire campaign.
And the stakes have literally never been higher. I mean, our mission for you today is to sift through this mountain of evidence to summarize the critical open threads. We're looking at the unresolved questions and the apocalyptic ticking time bombs just hanging over this party as they head into their finale.
Yeah, and there are a lot of bombs.
So many. But if there's one thing you need to keep in mind as we navigate this, it is that multiple perspectives and critical thinking are absolutely essential here.
Oh, for sure.
Because the party's own moral compass, like the people who are supposedly the heroes solving these crises, is deeply compromised. I mean, they were just as likely to cause the end of the world as they are to prevent it.
Okay, let's unpack this because the state of the city of Holland right now is just pure, unadulterated chaos. And to understand just how bad it is, we really need to start with the biggest, most existential threat on the board.
The god assassination.
Exactly. We are talking about a literal attempt to assassinate a god.
Which, brings us to the Lich,
Yeah.
Ishan. Normally, in these types of campaigns, a villain wants political power or infinite wealth or, I don't know, maybe revenge for some ancient slight.
Right, the usual bad guy stuff.
Yeah, but Ishild is driven by something much colder. It's just pure psychopathic mathematics. He is entirely obsessed with paradoxes, specifically something in this world called the omnipotent Ajana paradox.
Yeah, I read through the notes on this, and the paradox itself sounds like a standard, like, philosophy 101 question. It goes,
Yeah.
can the god Ajana create a rock that they cannot lift?
Right. And most philosophers look at that and just see a quirk of language,
Yeah.
But Ishild looks at it as a reductio ad absurdum proof.
A what now?
Reductio ad absurdum. In formal logic, it's a method where you assume a premise is true, and if that premise leads to a logical contradiction, then the original assumption just must be false.
Okay, so he's using it as actual math.
Exactly.
Well.
Ishild's logic is that the paradox proves, mathematically, that an omnipotent Ajana cannot exist. But he doesn't just, passively accept this mathematical proof. He takes it as a personal directive to enforce the math on reality.
Wow.
Yeah, he intends to physically ensure that this god does not exist by summoning Ajana into a mortal vessel and killing him.
But wait, flawless logic. I mean, he's relying on a linguistic riddle to justify building what is essentially a magical nuclear bomb. How is that flawless?
Because he isn't just using the Ajana paradox. His entire worldview is built on these logical absolutes. I mean, he references the barber paradox.
No, the one about the town with only one barber.
Yeah, the barber who shaves all the men who don't shave themselves. So, who shaves the barber? If he shaves himself, he breaks the rule. If he doesn't, he breaks the rule.
Right, it's an impossible loop.
Exactly. And Ishild sees divinity the same way. It's a glitch in the universe's math that he just feels compelled to correct.
And to correct that glitch, he needs two highly volatile components. First, he needs the true name of God. And this is where the party's questionable morality first rears its head, because they actually helped him find this out from the ancient Steam Reasoning Guild.
Yeah, they really did.
They discovered that the true name of Ajana is, quote, every true statement that can't be proven true. Which, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, so you have to explain that one to me. How does a math theorem translate into a magical true name?
Well, think about it this way. It's a direct nod to Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorems from our real world. Back in the 1930s, Gödel proved that in any complex mathematical system, no matter how robust, there will always be true statements that simply cannot be proven within that system.
It completely broke the brains of mathematicians at the time, right?
Totally broke them, because it meant math couldn't prove everything. So in the Holland Codex, since Ajana is the god of paradox and logic, their very essence is the unprovable truth. To summon a god of paradox, you just have to invoke the ultimate mathematical paradox.
That is seriously mind-bending. But the second component is where things get genuinely terrifying for the physical world. To power the summoning, Isheld needs 20 million gold pieces worth of doubly refined green cake.
Which is just an unfathomable amount.
It is. And to understand what that means, the party had to sail to the planet's arcane north pole on the continent of Hild to this place called the Abandoned Hargraves Mine. This is where the planet's longitudinal ley lines actually converge, concentrating raw arcane energy directly into the Earth's salt deposits.
And what they learn at this mine completely recontextualizes what green cake actually is. The party meets the ghost of a researcher named Jovi, who died in a catastrophic accident there.
Yeah, that part was super dark.
It really was. She explains that the energy most summoners extract from normal green cake is just chemical energy, like a small, manageable burn. But the salt itself holds something far more unstable, deeply embedded in its structure, which is arcane nuclear energy.
Wait, how do you build a god-killing bomb out of salt? What does doubly refined actually mean here? Are we talking about like a filter?
Oh, far more intense than a filter. We're talking about massive industrial centrifuges, fractional crystallization.
Okay, what is that?
It's a process where you dissolve the salt, and as it cools, the different isotopes crystallize at different rates. They're physically separating the mundane chemical elements from the raw, volatile arcane radiation.
Wow.
And when you refine it to that extreme degree and you gather a critical mass of those pure arcane isotopes in one place, it spontaneously releases that energy all at once.
So it literally goes critical. I mean, Jovi and her entire crew were instantly killed by a massive release of that arcane radiation. And that was just an accident. Isheld wants to weaponize it intentionally.
Exactly.
We know from Kaskar, that rogue trader back in Holland, that a mere cigar box of normal, unrefined green cake was enough to summon Lahar, the literal personification of death.
What's fascinating here is the sheer scale of Isheld's ambition compared to Kaskar's anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
A cigar box summons death. Isheld is demanding 20 million gold pieces worth of a substance that has been doubly refined to a weapons-grade isotope.
It's insane.
He isn't making a mistake in his calculations, you know. He knows exactly the yield of the bomb he is building.
Which brings up the crucial question for the finale, and honestly the most damning indictment of the party yet. The party actually agreed to help him.
Yes, they did.
They already delivered 5 million gold pieces worth of this arcane nuke to the Lich, and promised to bring him the rest in exchange for a 10 million gold piece payout. Are they actually going to go through with arming a Lich with arcane nukes?
It's a huge question.
Because if Isheld summons the god and the god doesn't exist, or the summoning fails to consume all that exponential energy, it doesn't just fizzle out. It will literally level the entire city of Holland. They are getting paid 10 million gold to hand over the detonator.
It perfectly highlights that moral vacuum we talked about in the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, they are facilitating a nuclear god assassination for a payday. They aren't trying to save the world. They are trying to cash out before it ends.
Yeah, that's so true. But let's play devil's advocate. Let's say the bomb goes off, the god is dead, but the blast is contained. The city of Holland survives. That brings us to our next massive problem.
The politics.
Right, who is actually left to run the city? Because the political structure of the Anhalt Charter Company and the Gradskin throne is completely tearing itself apart.
The political situation is the knife fight in the kitchen. For 1,000 years, the Circle, which is this covert faction of fairies, has been playing an unimaginably long game to control the city.
Yeah, and their strategy is insidious.
Very. They replace the human babies of the company's board members with fairy changelings.
But how does that even work long term? I mean, people would notice if their kids suddenly had wings and pointed ears, right?
Well, the fairies utilize a mushroom ring that operates on intense time dilation and brainwashing. They raise the stolen human children inside this ring, entirely isolated from reality.
Oh, wow.
Meanwhile, the fairy changelings, like the characters Luna Whitman, Flora Shaw, and Violet Volstead, are glamored to look human.
Sneaky.
Right? And they are raised in human high society, absorbing all the wealth and political connections. The ultimate plan is to insert the brainwashed human adults back into society as sleeper agents who think they are in charge, while the changelings actually pull the strings from the boardroom.
But that 1,000-year plan is spectacularly blowing up right now. It all came to a head at the Advocate's Court. The party is put on trial by Holly, the company advocate, and the board chair, Lily.
Yeah, the trial scene was wild.
Completely wild, because during the trial, the secret police chief Colfax takes the stand and drops an absolute bombshell. Lily and Holly are themselves fairy infiltrators. The courtroom just devolves into utter panic.
And in that moment of exposure, Lily realizes the thousand-year deception is over. She drops the mask entirely. She publicly admits she's a fairy, and then she looks directly at the other board members, Mia, Zoe, and Jorvik, and threatens to execute their real human children.
Who are still trapped in the mushroom ring.
Exactly. She threatens to kill them if the board doesn't vote to convict the party right then and there.
Which prompts Kiltak, the party's barbarian, to just walk up and decapitate Lily right there in the middle of the courtroom. Total chaos.
Just absolute chaos.
Now the surviving human board members have taken Holly hostage to try and force the return of their real children. Wait, so the party is just letting this happen? They're just watching the government collapse.
Oh, they aren't just watching it collapse. They are actively manipulating the rubble. Remember the rogue, Virgil? Earlier in the campaign, he managed to get his hands on an incredibly potent, highly illegal aphrodisiac called Love and Idleness.
Oh, no.
And he didn't just use it on a palace guard or a wealthy merchant to get some gold. He used it to mind control the fairy queen herself, Aurora.
So what does this all mean? We have a situation that is essentially a hostile corporate takeover crossed with a high-stakes fantasy soap opera.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Because on one hand, the party has been forging stock transfers for Millicent, the so-called rat queen, who lives in the cisterns but is actually the legitimate rightful heir to the Gradskin throne. They're supposedly helping her reclaim her birthright.
Supposedly, yeah.
But on the other hand, because Virgil literally controls the fairy queen, and because the party is holding all this forged stock, they are openly debating betraying Millicent. They are talking about, as they put it in their notes, pulling a Palpatine.
Using their leverage to just sweep away both the humans and the fairies to take over the board and rule Holland themselves. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this thread is a massive ticking bomb for the final two or three games. You have the crumbling remnants of a thousand-year fairy conspiracy. You have desperate human parents holding a fairy advocate hostage at knife point.
Right.
You have human children still missing somewhere deep in a time-dilated fairy mushroom ring. And you have Millicent, who possesses the legitimate royal bloodline, ready to march out of the sewers and take back her throne. The party holds literally all the keys to this kingdom, but they have absolutely no clear moral allegiance to any of these factions.
Yeah.
But, like, if they do pull a Palpatine and usurp the throne, they're going to need serious muscle to enforce that rule. And that is a huge problem, because they just lost their primary healer and one of their strongest fighters in the most brutal way imaginable.
Oh, yes.
We absolutely have to talk about the ultimate wildcard heading into the finale. The party's former ally, Barnaby.
Ugh.
Barnaby Veer. He is a cleric of Grodzka, the god of war. But, you know, throughout the campaign, he has repeatedly pointed out that he serves this war god, quote, not willingly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And frankly, this is one of the most calculating things I have ever seen a player do in a campaign.
It's chilling.
It really is.
Yeah.
The party goes to the Brockhaus Monument, which is this massive underground crypt, to help the ghost of Winnie Brock. Winnie has been cursed for over 400 years, trapped in a state of unrest because of something called the Two Guards Riddle.
Which is a classic logic problem.
Yep.
To find peace, Winnie has to ask one single question to two ghosts, Brand Hill and Wormworth. The rules of the curse dictate that one ghost always lies and one ghost always tells the truth.
Right.
She has to figure out which one actually loved her. And the party went to extraordinary lengths to find the mathematical solution to this exact riddle so they could finally lift her curse.
They mapped out the logic. They knew exactly how to phrase a compound question where the lie cancels out the truth, pointing directly to the correct ghost. They literally had the answer in their hands.
Yeah, they were ready.
They go down into the fourth basement to deliver the answer to Winnie. And what does Barnaby do? He goes completely rogue. He sprints ahead of the party, walks up to the ghost of Brand Hill, and intentionally wastes the one single question allowed to break the curse.
It's just so brutal.
He looks at the ghost and asks, does 2 + 2 = 4? I was sick reading this. Why would he do that?
Because Brand Hill answers yes. Now, why does that matter? It tells Barnaby what he selfishly wanted to know, that Brand Hill is the honest ghost.
Okay, but why does he care if Brand is honest?
In the lore of this world, Brand Hill's bloodline ties back to the Gradskin throne, which is intimately connected to Barnaby's war god. Barnaby needed to verify if that specific bloodline was legitimate.
Oh, wow.
But by burning the only question on a simple math equation, he permanently, eternally seals Winnie Brock's curse. She can never find peace now. Her chance is gone forever.
It is so casually cruel. I mean, he completely betrays the party, ruins a soul for eternity just to get a piece of trivia about a royal bloodline, and then uses a magical cloak to turn into an invisible moon shadow and vanish before the party can even draw their weapons.
He just blinks out of existence.
It turns Barnaby into a horror movie villain who had been hiding in plain sight as the party's healer this whole time.
And the consequences of his actions are actively hunting him down.
Yeah.
I mean, a new character has joined the party for the finale, a druid named Victor Ashbourne.
Oh, Victor. Yeah.
Victor reveals that years ago, Barnaby came to his clan pretending to be a savior. He manipulated Victor's people into going to war with a neighboring group, leading to the utter slaughter of his entire village. And Victor says that as his people were being massacred, Barnaby just stood there and laughed.
That is messed up. So Victor has been tracking Barnaby's scent across the continent ever since. He joins a party, and he uses this tracking ability to follow Barnaby's trail right into the shipyards.
Yep.
And this is how we connect the rogue cleric to the end of the world. The scent leads them to Vorman's prosthetic shop. But Vorman isn't just making wooden legs for injured sailors. The party breaks into his basement and finds a full-blown apocalyptic workshop.
It's like a mad scientist's lab.
Exactly. There are massive wind-up mechanical spiders. They find automated mannequins churning out hundreds of copies of a spell scroll called Numa.
This raises an important question for you, the listener, as we look at the board for the final sessions. How does a rogue cleric of the war god tie into what is happening in that basement?
Right.
Because on the altar down there, they find a book by the missing mathematician Manfred Unger. It's called Astronomical Clocks and the End Time, Volume 2.
Wait, how does a clock end the universe? A clock just measures time. It doesn't create it.
Usually, yes. But remember those Numa scrolls. In ancient Greek, Numa translates to breath or spirit.
Okay.
These aren't just gears and springs. The scrolls infuse the mechanical spiders with a kind of artificial life force, allowing them to build these impossibly complex astronomical clocks. And these clocks don't just track time. They manipulate the local temporal field.
Oh, man.
They are literally fast-forwarding the universe's entropy. They are designed to actively hasten the end of time.
And the math in Manfred Unger's book calculates that the end of the universe is going to happen in just 13.5 years, unless these clocks speed it up to happen, like, tomorrow.
Exactly.
So in these final games, who is the real final boss? Is it Ishild, the Lich, trying to nuke a god? Or is it their former friend Barnaby, the sociopathic cleric of war, tied up with mechanical spiders building doomsday clocks?
The convergence of these threads just guarantees a catastrophic finale. I mean, you have Ishil pushing the universe toward a mathematical paradox that unmakes divinity. You have the circle's political destabilization opening a massive power vacuum in the city. And you have these rogue elements tied to the god of war, quite literally accelerating the clock toward the end of time. None of these events are happening in a vacuum. They are all crashing into each other right at this exact moment.
It is an incredible amount of weight resting on just two or three final sessions. We were asked to summarize the open threads for this campaign, and the list is staggering.
It really is.
They have to survive or stop a nuclear green cake god assassination. They have to decide the entire political fate of Holland. Do they hand the board back to the humans? Do they crown the rat queen? Or do they usurp power themselves?
So forget the kids.
Right. They still have to figure out how to rescue the human babies from the time-dilated fairy mushroom ring. And they have to deal with a rogue war cleric and a literal end-of-time clock.
And yet, amidst all of those incredibly loud world-ending threats, there is one final eerie loose thread that hasn't been resolved. Something so quiet, it might actually be the most dangerous thing of all.
Oh, wait, the figurine? I kept seeing mentions of this in the notes, but it never seemed to connect to the main plot.
The mystery of the sleeping figurine. It is a detail that connects two vastly different, highly magical locations in this world. And it has never been explained.
Right. So when the party is up at the arcane North Pole, hundreds of miles away in the Hargraves Green Cake Mine, they find three small chapels carved entirely out of salt. One has a statue of the god Ajana, but another chapel has a figurine of a sleeping figure.
And earlier in the campaign, deep beneath the city of Holland, at the absolute bottom of the vampire colony's Moonwell Temple of Night, they found the exact same setup.
Wow.
Three chapels, one to Ajana, and one featuring that exact same sleeping figurine, an ancient vampire cult and an arcane nuclear salt mine separated by an ocean, both venerating a sleeping god.
Who or what is this sleeping figure? If the universe is ending and gods are being summoned to be assassinated, will this sleeping god wake up before the campaign ends?
It is the ultimate unknown variable. We know the math behind the nuclear blast, we know the politics of the fairies, and we know the betrayals of the war cleric. But we don't know what happens if whatever is dreaming at the bottom of the world finally opens its eyes.
That is terrifying.
Keep questioning the information around you, because in Holland, the most dangerous threats are often the ones you don't fully understand until it's too late.
Well said. We want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Holland Codex. And as you wait to see how this epic story concludes in these final sessions, just remember, it is hard enough to defuse a bomb when you know what you are doing.
Yeah.
It's a whole lot harder when the house is on fire, your roommates are trying to kill each other, and you are starting to suspect you might actually be the one who lit the match.